Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and welcome to the Conversations Politics podcast from Canberra. The story about Australia spying on Indonesian figures, including eavesdropping on the president and his wife and other leading figures in that country, has dominated politics in Australia for the last couple of days. It's caused outrage in Indonesia, and Tony Abbott has made an expression of regret about the embarrassment to the president, but has refused to apologise. Andrew Wilkie, the independent MP from Tasmania, was an intelligence officer working with the Office of National Assessments for some time before he became a whistleblower about the Iraq intelligence material. He knows a lot about spying and spooks, and we spoke to him today about the latest revelations and their implications for the relationship with Indonesia. Andrew Wilkie, you've been a former intelligence officer with the Office of National Assessments, and you've also been a whistleblower. Just casting back to that earlier role, if you'd seen this material and these revelations about spying at the highest level of Indonesian officialdom, what would have been your reaction? Would you have thought that's going too far, or would you have thought this is potentially really useful intelligence?
I'm sure there are many in the Australian intelligence community at the moment who are horrified at Snowden's disclosures and the disclosure in recent days of spying or attempted spying on the Indonesian president and others. Mind you, that won't be all of the members of the community. Some will think, well, that's fair enough, you know, so long as these revelations don't disclose any genuinely sensitive capability, so long as they don't reveal the name of a source, so long as no one is put at risk or hurt, then it's probably not a bad thing that the public is more aware of what the intelligence community does. I find it actually quite surprising that there is such a strong response within Australia to these revelations, because I don't know what some people think the role of the foreign intelligence collection agencies are. I mean, obviously it's to spy in and against countries in our region and other countries.
You mean a critical response?
Yes, well, there has been some critical response I've followed in the media and, you know, on Facebook, Twitter. A small number of phone calls and emails to my office, not a lot, but enough for me to say that I think we do need to educate the community better. Maybe this is a good thing. Mm. Maybe some on the inside would agree that it's a good thing that some of the naivety about what Australia's intelligence community does, that some of that naivety is addressed.
So you think it's fair enough for the intelligence organisations to spy on friendly leaders?
Look, if I could talk broadly first and then narrow my answer down. It is perfectly legitimate in this day and age for Australia's foreign intelligence agencies to spy in and against other countries, in particular in our region. Now, look, in a perfect world, we wouldn't need to spy on people. We wouldn't need to eavesdrop. But it's not a perfect world. And we do need to know what's going on in these countries. And sometimes the only way to find out is through intelligence collection work. You know, you can't find out everything you need to know just by talking to a foreign diplomat or reading a foreign newspaper. You know, we do need to know what terrorism suspects or terrorist suspects are saying to each other. We do need to know what people suspected of people smuggling are saying to each other. And as I narrow it down a little bit now, we do need to know what the leadership of regional countries, what those leaders are thinking, what their intentions are, what their views and concerns are about Australia. The alternative is to have an intelligence vacuum where you don't understand the leadership figures well, you don't understand what's going on in those countries well, and in those circumstances you can be caught by surprise. I would argue that effective intelligence collection in other countries helps us to understand those countries better and actually fosters more stable relationships. In fact, if I could hark back 10 years to the invasion of Iraq, one of the reasons that George W. Bush, our own John Howard and others were able to create the story that they created about Iraq was that there had been an intelligence vacuum in Iraq which political leaders were able to backfill with whatever they wanted. Now, coming forward, I could make the same observation. If there's a country in the region and we don't know what's going on, we can, and in some ways we should assume the worst, and that's not good for relations.
Can you tell us something about the then-named Defence Signals Directorate, which does this listening?
Something about it?
Yes. How it works, what it is?
Well, very, very broadly, it's part of the Department of Defence, and until quite recently was called the Defence Signals Directorate.
And now renamed.
Now renamed the Australian Signals Directorate. I think probably quite rightly, because that would better describe its role. It's really a national asset, not simply a defence asset. It has a range of capabilities to monitor, to listen in, to record technical communications, whether that might be, for example, mobile phone calls, telemetry, for example, if someone's doing a rocket test. Basically, when any signal passes through the air, it can be intercepted either between towers or between a phone and a tower or between, you know, up to a satellite. Obviously, they have, and there's nothing, hardly anything secret about what I'm saying here, obviously they have very sophisticated technology, very powerful computers that allow them not only to listen in to communications and to record them, but even to even apparently secure communication. They have some capability to listen in on those as well.
Of course, a few years ago, I think it was covered by what were then called D-notices, and its activities weren't even referred to in the media under a voluntary code.
I think one of the few good things to come out of the Iraq War was that it shone a big bright light on the Australian intelligence community and how it operates. I myself, when I left the Office of National Assessments, wrote a short book which went into a little bit of detail to describe the way these agencies operate. Although I would hasten to add, I was very careful myself not to disclose any secret information about, you know, particular capabilities, and nor should I have. And even this discussion these days, you know, in some ways, Mr. Snowden, the American former NSA contractor, in some ways he's done us done a public service by letting people learn more about the work of the intelligence agencies and what they can do. I think that's in the public interest. We need to know what these people get up to in broad terms. We need to know how they spend our billions of dollars. I think that's good that we know more these days.
I think a few of the politicians who are burnt by this might disagree there. But given the crisis that's now arisen in Australian-Indonesian relations as a result of these disclosures, what should Australia do now?
Well, it obviously has a very complex diplomatic problem to solve now, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But as far as the intelligence operations go, let's go into this with our eyes open. All of the countries in the region are spying on other countries in the region. And the Indonesian government right now knows that. They're running their own intelligence collection operations in other countries, and no doubt including in Australia. So much of this outrage is really political theatre, in my opinion, for their own domestic audience. I mean, you know, they would quite understandably feel the need to appear and to act outraged, and to recall the ambassador is a perfectly understandable thing for them to do. They've got to worry about their own credentials in their own community as being a strong government standing up for Indonesia's national interests. They're also political candidates in the lead up to their own national election due next year. You know, they've got to not only survive this politically, they want to score points. They want to save face. They want to look for ways to leverage off this to get some sort of benefit. Just as the Germans have won greater intelligence cooperation with the United States, off the back of the revelation of the Americans eavesdropping on the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. You know, to smooth it over, the Americans promised closer cooperation, greater intelligence sharing. So there's an awful lot going on here, mm-hmm. which is all about the Indonesian domestic audience. It's not like they didn't know before this we spy in Indonesia. In fact, we share intelligence information with them that we collect a lot of the time anyway, when it's in our mutual interest. For the Indonesian foreign minister to say, I think last night, that Indonesia doesn't spy on Australia, it's just fanciful. That's not to say it's not unpalatable, but everyone's doing it and everyone needs to do it because it's an imperfect world. And I tell you what, we not only are we better placed to deal with the terrorist threat that might emanate from Indonesia, not only are we better placed to deal with the people smuggler industry in Indonesia because of our intelligence collection in Indonesia, we're also better placed to understand the Indonesian government, to understand the Indonesian leaders, to be able to deal more effectively with them and actually to foster a better relationship in so many ways.
Do you think that Tony Abbott, who said he didn't feel he needed to apologise, should he in fact apologise?
Well, no, because now he's also got the problem of the Australian domestic audience. And I don't think the majority of Australians would, I might be wrong, but I don't think the majority of Australians would want him to apologise. I don't think there is any need to apologise for us going about our business just as the Indonesians are going about theirs. Now, it's a very rare thing for me to compliment a coalition government on security matters, and in my 10 years in public life I have been consistently very critical of the coalition when it's come to security matters, whether it be Iraq or Afghanistan or probably any number of other things. But I actually found the Prime Minister's statement at the start of question time today very carefully crafted and quite effective. I think he struck a pretty good balance today.
And what did you think of Bill Shorten's statement?
I thought that was also well-crafted and effective. Of course, both parties find themselves in a bit of an awkward situation here.
Because all this happened under Labor, of course.
Well, that's right.
It's come out.
That's right. Snowden's revelations are about spying that happened on Labor's watch. But, of course, we'd be spying on Indonesia today on the coalition's watch. So they're all, they're co-conspirators. So it's no surprise that they are acting collegiately at this point in time.
My understanding is that spying goes on without having to get any permission from politicians to do it, to spy on leaders, for example. Do you think that is proper?
Well, I've been out of the intelligence community for 10 years, and although I was a member of the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security in the last Parliament, we didn't look into these sorts of matters. So I'm not claiming to know anything more than you, really. Although, I think back 10 years, and it probably is still the case, that broad guidance was given by the government of the day about the focus of our intelligence activities. But that problem, that almost certainly wouldn't go to whether or not to spy on the president of a country. That sort of detail would probably be developed as part of each agency's detailed collection plan. But I would be very surprised, if the head of an agency would be collecting intelligence on the head of another country without having discussed it and cleared it with their relevant minister, which in DSD's case would be the Defence Minister, of course. With ASIS, it would be the Foreign Minister. I think we can safely assume that any collection activity that has occurred and is going on currently directed at heads of state, heads of government, our political leadership would have given that their blessing.
Do you feel that there's enough control over our intelligence agencies generally?
Yes and no. Yes, in that compared to other countries, we have very competent intelligence agencies. There are quite effective protections in place to protect the rights and the privacy of Australian citizens who might be the subject of surveillance by intelligence agencies. It can always be done better, And, you know, in recent months there's been some media reporting of the fact that security agencies can access call data and so-called metadata without warrant. So perhaps something could be tightened up there. Now, I said yes and no. That was the yes bit. The no bit is, interestingly, in Australia, there is no parliamentary oversight of operational intelligence matters. The Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security, strictly speaking, only oversees the administration of the intelligence agencies, compared with the US, where there is congressional oversight of operational matters. Now, personally, I would like to see the PJCIS, or perhaps some new parliamentary committee, have at least some oversight of operational matters. Currently, that operational oversight is in the hands of the relevant minister, the Attorney General for ASIS, as I said earlier, the Foreign Minister for... Attorney General for ASIO, the Foreign Minister for ASIS, the Prime Minister for ONA, the Defence Minister for DSD or ASD, and DIGO and DIO. There's a lot of acronyms in one long sentence. That could be tightened up. The Parliament could, and we certainly have people in the Parliament who could be trusted to have such oversight. And an issue like whether or not to collect technical intelligence on a head of state, head of government, is the sort of thing I think that such a committee would have oversight of.
Of course, the parliamentarians might prefer to keep their distance from some of these more controversial sort of decisions.
Oh, look, I think parliamentarians would be falling over each other to be on such a committee. It's interesting at the moment, there's all the manoeuvring to get on the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security. I'd like to be on that committee myself, but I think I'm well down the food chain these days.
Everyone likes a good spy story.
Everyone likes a good spy story. Everyone likes to go into the tent, and most people who go into the tent find it quite exciting and intoxicating. And there'd be no trouble filling it with appropriate people. I mean, within the Parliament, there's former defence ministers, former attorneys general. And others who are quite experienced in handling the most sensitive information, and would be quite well equipped to be on a committee that has operational oversight of the intelligence community.
Just coming back to the general relationship with Indonesia, you've indicated that you think that the Indonesians are putting on a bit more of a show, hyping this up for their own political reasons. How long do you think this will cause some fracture in the relationship? If it's just being used politically, you could argue, well, it'll be over soon, or you could say, well, they have got that presidential election next year, so it could go on quite a while.
I suspect it will go on quite a while, if only because of the timeline for their own election, as you've correctly described. These things come and go. You know, we everyone gets all very, very... exercised about them at the time, but
how would you relate it? How would you rate it compared to, say, the ban that was imposed for a while on the cattle trade, which caused fracture?
I think this is more serious than that diplomatically, because this has been personalised. Even though the Indonesian president would have known that, you know, we're spying on Indonesia, and he's spying on us. So in many ways, there's nothing remarkable in this.
But it comes to face, the question of
face. Yeah, but there is the issue of face, but there's also the issue that when you see your own name on a list and your wife's name on a list, I suspect there is, to some degree, an emotional response which overlays the more common response in other situations. You know, much has been made about the fact that the Indonesian president's wife's on the list, but Australians need to understand the Indonesian president's wife is a very senior and active political operative herself. And even if she wasn't, so-called pillow talk allows all sorts of secrets to be shared.
So you don't think Margie Abbott will be on that list in the childcare centre that she works in Sydney?
Well, it's just hardly sharing any dark sort of art or secret of intelligence. But it's one thing to target a person who knows a secret. It also can often be very productive to target the person who knows the person who has a secret.
Maybe Maggie should be careful of that phone.
Well, you know, I think that maybe one of the things that comes out of this latest revelation is that people need to understand there are all these countries out there collecting all sorts of intelligence, human intelligence, technical intelligence, listening into all sorts of things. There are precious few secrets these days, and you know, I'm a former intelligence official. I'm a member of a parliament. I'm a former member of the intelligence committee. I mean, for all I know, any number of people listening, trying to listen into my conversations, I don't care.
That's fair enough. Now, you got re-elected despite being an independent. It's always a big thing for an independent to defy the big parties and hold his or her seat. Your big thing last term was fighting the gambling industry, trying to get more control on it. I think you'd say that that didn't turn out at all well. Have you lost all hope of doing anything in that area?
I will continue to work on gambling reform. It is worth remembering, though, that even though the Prime Minister reneged on her deal with me for deep reform, the government still went ahead with watered-down reform, which includes the fitting of pre-commitment technology to machines over a number of years. Now, it's for voluntary use, which is actually useless, worthless, but I did secure an amendment to the bill which requires that the machines be, in essence, capable of mandatory pre-commitment at the flick of a switch, i.e. from voluntary to mandatory, without any significant change to the machines. That's actually worth something, and that means at a point in the future a state or territory government could flick the switch from voluntary to mandatory within their own jurisdiction. So for me, as far as pokies reform goes, my first job is to try and pressure the government not to overturn those watered-down reforms, which the then opposition did promise to do before the election. So I can only hope that the new Senate will be like-minded and will not agree to the repeal of those laws. More broadly, I have a blueprint for the next 3 years. It has three key clusters, really, of issues. The first cluster is doing my best to try and protect the good reforms of the 43rd Parliament. For example, a price on carbon, a mining tax, as imperfect as it is and desperately in need of amendment, the National Broadband Network, National Disability Insurance Scheme, Gonski Education Reforms. In almost every case, they weren't constructed perfectly and weren't rolled out all that well, but each has great merit. So at every opportunity, I'll speak in their defence and vote against them being repealed. The second cluster is, and this might surprise you, it's a very Tasmanian thing, is doing whatever I can to foster economic development in Tasmania. Something has to change. It is completely unacceptable that Tasmania remains the poorest and most disadvantaged of all the states when it is a place of such enormous potential. And one of the obvious ways, and I'm going to ask a question hopefully tomorrow on question time tomorrow of the Prime Minister about this, one of the things we really need to rectify is the cost of getting people, vehicles and freight in and out of the state. An enormous brake on economic development. And the third cluster of issues is all around cutting a better deal for the disadvantaged. And I do worry that in any government, in any parliament, the disadvantaged often miss out, but I worry that over the next 3 years they're going to be targeted, whether it be single parents, people on Newstart, aged pensioners, people on youth allowance, people relying on the public health system, the public education system, that very large group of Australians out there who need a loud voice sticking up for them in the federal parliament. So that's my broad sort of approach to this parliament.
You and other crossbenchers were, of course, totally vital in the House last time and run off your collective feet as people tried to court you to one side or another in key votes. Is there a bit of a feeling of rooster to feather duster now that the Parliament is not hung anymore?
Well, there is no doubt. I don't have nearly as much power in this Parliament. This isn't a power-sharing Parliament as the last one was, and I prefer to use the term power-sharing than hung. I never felt that I was literally hanging from the end of a rope, but I was run ragged. Look, the challenge for me is to remain a good local member, which really doesn't have much to do with the numbers in the House. I was always very careful in the last Parliament not to let it go to my head and not to be distracted, and I always worked hard in the electorate, and I'll continue to do that. The challenge is to remain a person of influence in Canberra. It's early days, but I'm still enjoying access to ministers. I think I can still be a loud and effective voice in Canberra and push for reform.
And you can get the odd cup of tea with Tony Abbott?
I haven't yet, but maybe I will. But interestingly, ministers are picking up their phones, and I have had some help with some issues already, which is very heartening. I suppose from a raw political point of view, from the Liberal Party's point of view, I hold Labor out of what would otherwise be a safe Labor seat. So it's in their interests not to be hostile to me and to push me out, because I'll only be replaced by the Labor candidate at the next election.
And politicians know that in certain circumstances every seat can count. Andrew Wilkie, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
That was Andrew Wilkie, and that's all for now. You can subscribe to this podcast via your chosen client. If you're listening on iTunes or on the Windows Phone Store, please leave a rating or a comment. Thanks to my producer, Matt Dawson. You can read me on The Conversation and follow me on Twitter. Thanks again for listening. See you next time.